TUC Radio, San Francisco. Time of Useful Consciousness. Howard Lyman and Mad Cows. A lone fight against some giants of industrial agriculture. The recent news about mad cow disease reminded me of my first encounter with the Montana rancher Howard Lyman in 1998. He and Oprah Winfrey had just gone through the mad cow trial in Amarillo, Texas. They had been sued by Texas cattlemen and feedlot operators because Lyman had said, on the Oprah Winfrey show, that mad cow disease, as it raged in England at that time and claimed its first human victims, could already be in the U.S. Since Lyman's warning, the first case of mad cow disease has been confirmed in the U.S. We still do not know how widespread it is, since less than 1% of the U.S. cattle are tested for mad cow disease. The story of one rancher who's keeping up the fight against a huge industry will be told in part two of this program. In today's segment, Lyman explains how he realized what chemical agriculture did to his farm, his family, and himself, and what gave him the strength to keep up the fight against mad cow disease that is only now beginning to surface to a larger public. Here's Howard Lyman, recorded at the 22nd National Pesticide Forum in the summer of 2004.
I was raised during the Second World War. My parents owned the largest dairy farm in the state of Montana. Now, they couldn't hire any help, and so my mother and father, they were both milking cows. That meant that my grandparents raised my brother, two sisters, and I. Now, back then, there was no such thing as swing slides and Lego blocks. Back then, daycare was working in the garden. And my first job, 4 or 5 years old in the garden, was a pint jar, collecting ladybugs and putting them into the jar. Not to kill them, but to count them. The more ladybugs, the healthier the garden was. I thought it was the Garden of Eden. I knew that that's exactly what I wanted to do the rest of my life. Birds, trees, and living soil. And so, I wanted to be a farmer. My parents had a farm. 12 years I could go to school. I didn't have to do anything but party and play football. And I guarantee you, I never missed a party. 12 years ago in school, never one time did I ever take home a book. I didn't need that. I was too busy partying. And believe it or not, my senior year, they came to me and they said, Lyman, you're going to graduate. I almost had the big one right there. But I figured that out. You know, they looked at it and they said, you know, this guy is a doggone dumb. If we don't graduate him, he may come back. They didn't want to take a chance on that. They graduated me. I was thrilled to death. I went home to that farm. That farm was a business to be run. I didn't have the tools to run a business. I was dumber than a post. But I didn't let that bother me any. I wanted to be an agribusinessman. Now, I couldn't spell it, but that's what I wanted to be. I went to Montana State University. I was going to get a degree in agriculture, and I went there, and I learned a thing that was called better living through chemistry. I couldn't hardly believe it, you know? There I was. I learned about herbicides, pesticides, hormones, and medication. I soaked up that information like a sponge because I wanted to feed a hungry world. I ended up in Montana State getting a degree in agriculture. And I went home and I said to my father, I said, hey, Pop, move over. I'm going to take this one-horse farm and turn it into an agribusiness. And he looked at me and he said, what in the world is that? I said, man, didn't you ever hear about better living through chemistry? He said, no, no, our job is to work with nature. I said, oh, that's old-fashioned. My great-grandfather, my grandfather, my father, they were organic farmers. I was a chemical junkie. I took that farm, and over a period of years, I turned it into an operation where I had 7,000 head of cattle, 12,000 acres of crop, 30 employees. I'm telling you, I thought I was Farmer of the Year, spending over $100,000 a year buying chemicals. You know, we would buy chemicals, we would spray the crops. I can remember pulling the sprayer up to the well, sticking a hose into it from the well, mixing in the chemicals and going in to eat lunch in my house, and the chemicals in my clothing would kill my wife's plants. Just the vapor on my clothing. If the sprayer ran over a little and the water ran down the well, oh, so be it. It was safe. The government said it was okay. I can remember going to farm meetings where the chemical salesman would stand up in front of a group like this, and to show you how safe it was, he would pour some of it into a glass and then drink it to show you how safe it was. You think this is far-fetched? You remember Vietnam? We used Agent Orange, 245T. Our government hired natives to go from village to village with 245T and drink it in front of the other villagers to show them how safe it was. How many of those people do you believe are alive today? But I bought that. I thought it was okay. I thought it was on top of the world. And in 1968, my brother, 32 years old, died of Hodgkin's disease. And I thought, well, you know, somebody's going to get cancer. It's probably better him than me. And it wasn't until years later when I was talking to Dr. T. Colin Campbell, the man that identified dioxin for the first time, and he was sitting in my office, and he was holding his cheek. And I said to him, I said, "Hey, T, what in the world are you doing this for?" I was a pretty plain-spoken farm boy. And he said to me, he said, "I'm the guy that first came up with the revelation of dioxin, and it killed all of the muscles in my face." He said, "You know, we used it in Vietnam. It was called Agent Orange." He said, "Did anybody in your family ever die of cancer?" I said, "Yeah, I had a brother, 32 years old, died of Hodgkin's disease." First time in my life, I knew at that time that the chemicals we were using on the farm, 245T, better known as Agent Orange, would cause Hodgkin's disease in humans. We used it like soda pop. No gloves, goggles, protective gear. We just dumped it on. It was safe. We didn't have to worry about it because the government was looking out after us. Well, 1979, just when I thought I was on top of the world, I got a wake-up call. I ended up paralyzed from the waist down. The doctor told me, he said, "You have a tumor on your spinal cord." He said, "If that tumor is on the inside of the cord, you have less than one chance in a million you will ever walk again. If somebody gives you the odds of one in a million, they're saying to you, 'Hey, sucker, pick out the wheelchair you like, because you're going to be in it the rest of your life.'" Here I am in the hospital, flat on my back, and a lot of things going through my mind. It was not about having seven combines at $100,000 apiece, or 20 tractors, or 30 trucks. What I thought about was why I became a farmer. Birds, trees, and living soil. First time in years I was willing to reflect that the birds were dying, the trees were dying, the soil was changing. And it was the first time I was willing to admit I was part of the problem, not part of the solution. And that night, odds in one in a million, I have to admit to you that I expected that I would never walk again. And I wondered, what kind of an invalid am I going to be? Am I going to be in a wheelchair feeling sorry for myself? Or could I actually make my life amount to something? Could I do something worthwhile? And that night I made up my mind, whether I ever walked again or not, I would spend the rest of my life trying to get that farm back to what it was like when I was a kid, with birds and trees and living soil. They took me up and operated on me for 12 hours. I stand in front of you tonight. I have no bone on the back of part of my spinal column. And sure enough, after they cut the bone off, the tumor was on the inside of the cord. They split the covering on the cord. Not only was it on the inside, but it was under the cord. They took a tumor out of the inside of my spinal column, the size of my thumb. I walked out of the hospital with a 1 in a million operation. I don't think I walked out of the hospital because of the skill of my surgeon. I don't think I walked out of there because of the care of the hospital. I think I walked out of there the grace of God. But never again in my life was I going to go back and do what I did before, because I think what I learned in Montana State University, better living through chemistry, was nothing more than brainwashing. I knew that I had to commit myself. I had to start learning about organic farming. The first book I got was Rachel Carson's book, Silent Spring. First time in my life I knew what was happening to the birds and the trees and the soil. And then Francis Moore LePay and Wendell Berry and Thomas Berry, 2 years of being paralyzed and recovering, 7,000 head of cattle. I don't need to tell you the financial shape of my farm. And so I went and saw my banker, and I said to my banker, I said, I need your help. I need to start farming with nature. My banker, he reared back in the chair and he said, what in the world does that mean? I said, I think we need to become organic farmers. And he looked at me and he laughed. He said, you want me to lend you money? And you're not going to spend it with my other customers, the chemical dealer, the pharmaceutical dealer, the fertilizer dealer? He said, there will never be a day like that. And so 1983, I sold the majority of my farm. I paid my debts, but I never gave up on the commitment that I made. I started working with other farmers not to make the mistakes that I made. 1987, I got a phone call. They called me up and they said, how would you like to go to Washington, D.C. and work on Capitol Hill? I can remember looking up and saying, oh, 535 members of Congress. I just absolutely knew they wanted to do what was right. Well, I went to Washington, D.C. I worked 5 years on Capitol Hill. If you remember nothing else that I say tonight, I'd like you to remember what I learned 5 years working on Capitol Hill. I learned a thing called the golden rule. Them that got the gold are making the rules. I will tell you, we have absolutely the best government that money can buy. And I said to my friends, I said, you know, this game is rigged. The deck is marked. We'll never win in Washington, D.C. And my friends, they all looked at me and they laughed. And they said, well, what are you going to do? Go talk to the people? I said, yeah. And they said, oh, you're never going to get half of the people to do anything. I said, we don't need half. 80% of the population today is absolutely brain dead. They're part of the herd. They're following nose to tail. And when you follow nose to tail, there is only one thing you see in front of you. I said, what we need to do is we need to talk to the 20% that are still thinking. Because the future for you and I, our children, the environment, the animals, is to get off of this chemical bandwagon. Because it is absolutely killing everything that it touches. And then I started going out and talking to people about making a change. And remember, I spent 45 years of my life in animal production, and now I was talking to people about reducing their consumption of meat. My hometown newspaper called me a turncoat. But do you realize we organized 2,662 teams in front of 3,000 McDonald's and handed out 1 million pieces of literature in one day? And I believe that we started the awareness from the grassroots of what people could do when they came together. And so now I travel around and I say to people, you know, you don't have to become a flaming vegan, but you should be asking the question, who produces my food? What are they using on it? What's it doing to me, the animals, and the environment? And you know, right now, today, We have people that are questioning that. Do you realize that last year, Stanford University, 30% of all students' meals served in student food service was vegan? 30%. The National Restaurant Association today says 20% of all meals that are eaten in restaurants today in the United States of America are dictated by vegetarians. If you have five people going out to dinner and only one of them's a vegetarian, who do you think it is that's picking the restaurant they go to? We are seeing phenomenal things. Look at farmers' markets. Look at the growth of organic food that is out there. Look at the awareness of people when they're coming around and saying, well, everybody in the block wants to go with this chem law, and how about you? And we have people saying, no way, no way. We are seeing phenomenal changes. And so here I am, I'm traveling around and I'm talking to people, and you know, I'm just a kick-ass populist, and I'm out there saying to people, you know, you got to think about what's going on. But remember, I came from Montana. I was a 300-pound football player, and when I quit playing football, I kept eating the same way, and I got well over 300 pounds. My blood pressure was sky high. My cholesterol was over 300. I'd sit down and have lunch, and my nose would bleed. Well, I didn't think I was going to live very long that way, but the alternative was becoming a vegetarian. I came from Montana. I'd rather be caught riding a stolen horse than admitting to being a vegetarian. But I came up with an answer. I decided to become a closet vegetarian. Lettuce and dairy products. That was my diet for 1 year. I lost some weight. My blood pressure came down slightly. My cholesterol came down slightly. And I thought, wow, if I can do that, being the world's worst vegetarian, just think what I could do if I became vegan. And I could spell vegan. I became a vegan. I lost 130 pounds. My blood pressure went from sky high to normal. My cholesterol from 300 to 135. Not one person in 40 years of the longest ongoing heart study in the world, the Framingham study, ever had a heart attack that had a cholesterol reading below 150. I'm telling you what, I thought I was on top of the world. I had the answer. I couldn't hardly wait to share it with my friends, my family. You know, my wife and I have been married over 36 years. Never one time in 36 years have I ever regretted marrying my wife. Now, I married much better than she did, but I will tell you that she came with a mother for 36 years. It's been a severe test. And here I am thinking about calling up my mother-in-law and telling her about my diet, even though it had a potential to extend her life. I thought about that for a long, long time. But I thought it was the right thing to do, and so I picked up the phone, I called my mother-in-law, and I said, hey, Marge, I want to tell you about my new diet. And on the other end of the phone, I heard it go click. But I thought it was probably too direct of an approach, so I called her back, and I said, hey, Marge, why don't you and Ralph come to our house for Thanksgiving dinner? And she said, but you won't have turkey. I said, I'll tell you, if you come to our house for Thanksgiving dinner, I guarantee you we'll have turkey. She agreed to come. She knew she had me eating crow. Thanksgiving Day, my mother-in-law came in the house like a rocket. Immediately to the oven, opened the oven, no turkey. She looked in the refrigerator, no turkey. She even looked in the dryer, no turkey. And she said to me, you guaranteed we'd have turkey. I took my mother-in-law by the hand, took her to the back door. I opened up the back door, and in the backyard, I had a live turkey. I gave my mother-in-law an axe. And I told her, I said, if you want turkey, you got to kill it. Now, this story has got good news and bad news. The good news is that turkey's still alive. The bad news, so is my mother-in-law. But you know, I learned that you can't go to somebody and point at them and say, let me tell you what you ought to do. You can see their eyes roll up. You can actually hear their ears slam shut. And so I go around and I talk to people about making a change. And I basically say to them, you know, I don't want you to walk out of here tonight and say, oh, hallelujah, I've heard the gospel from Lyman. I want you to walk out and say, that's the craziest damn ex-farmer I ever saw in my life. I don't know whether there's anything he says is true. I want you to go to the bookstore, the library. I want you to walk out of here tonight and buy a copy of my book. They haven't told you, but you can't get out of this auditorium tonight without a copy of that under your arm. I'm pulling your leg. Two of you buying one book, you can get out of here. But you know, when you stop and look at some of the changes that have happened in the world, at one time, slavery was accepted. There was a time when women were not allowed to own property. There was a time when women were not allowed to vote. I will tell you that I think there will be a time with our children and grandchildren that they will come back and sit on your knee and say, really? Was there a time that we really ate animals? You know, 80% of all of the grain produced in North America today is stuffed down the throat of an animal. It takes 16 pounds of grain to put a pound of meat on your plate. 16 pounds of grain will feed 32 people or one Rush Limbaugh. Which is the best use of our resources? Now, I have people that come to me and say, wait a minute, it might not be a bad idea to continue to feed meat to Rush. If he continues to eat it, it may get him. I have to admit that that's an interesting thought. I'm not sure that it is the Christian approach, but it's really something to think about. There are 1.25 billion people that go to bed every night hungry. Should we not be feeding people and not animals? Do you realize that we lose a greater percentage of the crop worldwide today with all of the chemicals that we're using than we have ever lost in the history of the world? And if somebody wants to tell you it's better living through chemistry than we're going to feed a hungry world, absolutely nothing could be further from the truth. We need to understand that one out of every two people dying in the United States of America today are dying from heart disease. Main contributing factors, saturated fat and cholesterol. All cholesterol comes from animal products, 100%. No such thing as carrot cholesterol, kale cholesterol. You can't even mail order cabbage cholesterol. The majority of saturated fat in the American diet is coming from animal products. As we're sitting here tonight, one out of every three Americans will come down with cancer. One out of four will die of cancer. I want to tell you about a study in Cornell University. I want to warn you that there is no way in the world that we should look at an animal study and say that it will happen identically to humans. But this was an interesting study. They had 100 rats. And they took those 100 rats and they fed them aflatoxin. It's what happens on grain when you end up with certain kinds of weather conditions. It is one of the greatest carcinogens in the world, aflatoxin. And they fed aflatoxin to these 100 rats, and all 100 rats came down with cancer. And then they took the group and they split it in half, and they took 50 of them. And they put them on a diet that had 20% of their calories coming from animal protein. And the animal protein they picked was the cheapest that they could find, that they had a lot of, which was called casein. 87% of the protein in dairy products is casein. They had a lot of it. It was cheap. And they gave it to the rats. Of the 50 rats, that had 20% of the animal protein in their diet, every one of them died. They took the other 50. They put them on a ration that had 5% protein coming from plant sources, and those 50, even though they had cancer, thrived and lived and were able to deal with cancer, and none of them died. And they looked at it and they said, well, you know, the American diet, the standard American diet today, 17% of the diet is coming from animal protein. What we ought to do is see what happens if we took rats and we put them on a 15 or 17% animal protein diet. They did that, and two-thirds of them died. And so I say to you today, why in the world do we not wake up to the fact that the best way to deal with cancer and heart disease and diabetes and all of them is not another pill, not another chemical, it is prevention. The fork is the most dangerous weapon in the arsenal of the Homo sapiens. We're digging more graves with our fork than any other tool.
That was Howard Lyman, the former Montana cattle rancher. After leaving his farm, Lyman was an organizer with the Montana Farmers Union. In 1995, he formed the organization he now works for, Voice for a Viable Future. He's the author of Mad Cowboy. In the upcoming program of TUC Radio, you will hear about his fight against mad cow disease and his experience as co-defendant with Oprah Winfrey in the famous Amarillo, Texas mad cow trial. You can find more information on Howard Lyman and mad cows on TUC Radio's website, www.tucradio.org. That's tucradio.org. Look up the newest programs page. You can get information how to order a copy of the complete one-hour talk by Howard Lyman by calling us. TUC Radio is free to all radio stations. Your tape or CD order is the only support we receive and helps us stay on the air. Call us toll-free anytime at 877-TUC-TAPE for information on how to order. You can get your tape or CD by mail or credit card, by phone or on the web. Our toll-free phone number, 877-TUC-TAPE, translates into 1-877-882-8273. Time of Useful Consciousness is an aeronautical term, the time between the beginning of oxygen deficiency and the loss of consciousness. Time for the pilot to save the plane. My name is Maria Gelarden. Thank you for listening. Give us a call.